It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. What is real food, and how far would you go to find it?
I sold my house, I quit my job, and I embarked on this journey across six continents to go to the deep origins where our foods are born. I want to reclaim what's mine.
I'm Anne Strandchamps, and today we're talking about authenticity in cooking and eating, what it means and why it matters.
In our family, the highest compliment anything could get was that it tasted like Iran.
How have you found your identity in African-American, Jewish, gay culture through food?
I'm a little, as we used to call my grandmother, Grammy. So I'm a little Grammy, I'm a little Bubby. I'm a little queen mother of the house. I'm all of those pieces.
Today, we go looking for deep flavors, personal identity, and love in food.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Walk through the largest supermarket chain in America. 20 different kinds of potato chips, 153 flavors of ice cream, an acre of cold cereal. Why do we have so many choices? Or do we?
Good morning. How are you doing today?
At Walmart, I went through all the dairies. Our ice cream, our yogurts, our butters, our milks. 90% of them come from one breed of cow.
Simran Sethi is a food journalist, and where you and I see hundreds of varieties, she sees a scary sameness.
I'm all lost in the supermarket. I can't longer shop happily.
When I first started writing my book, people looked at me like I had two heads. You're writing about the loss of diversity? We have more than we've ever had, but a lot of that is an illusion. A lot of it is in diversity of flavors. When we look behind those labels, we usually see a tight handful of ingredients. So many things that we consume and partake of have been consolidated. You look to the produce aisle over to the bananas. We can grow over 1,000 different types of bananas in the world, but we see one on store shelves, and that's the Cavendish banana. It has succumbed to a different strain of the same fungus that wiped out its predecessor, the Big Mike banana. I would argue 90% of anything is not a good place to be when it comes to security. One pest or one disease could wipe out an entire crop or an entire breed.
All right, thank you.
Our question today, what is real food? And why does it matter? Simran Sethi broke the bad news about our shrinking global diet in her book Bread, Wine, and Chocolate, The Slow Loss of the Foods We Love. And here's the first fact that jumped out at me in her book. 3/4 of the world's food now comes from just 12 plants and 5 animal species. So think about it. That's like being told that everyone on the planet is wearing the same 17 items of clothing.
Exactly, except it's even worse than that, because when researchers analyzed 50 years of data on what 98% of the world eats, they found the majority of the world now eats the same types and the same amounts of wheat, rice, corn, soybean, and palm oil. So what this ostensibly means is that on this global level, this trend is towards sameness, and that homogeneity is really, it's dangerous.
Simran, this realization led you to quit your job, sell your house, give away your car, and travel around the world in search of,
I guess we could call it real food.
Right.
And I'll tell you the moment in your book that really got to me. It was when you said, try to imagine the world without chocolate. I mean, that's just heart-stopping for me. I have such deep emotional connections to it, and you do too, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I think of chocolate as being this substance that brings me great joy. It's mended my broken heart. It's been an expression of love. And I had no real sense of where it came from. And I went into the cocoa forest to tell you it comes from a bean-shaped area in the upper Amazon. This crosses Ecuador and Peru. And I remember entering into this forest where cacao grows in Ecuador, and I kept looking for it.
Could you smell it? Does the forest smell like chocolate?
No. There is absolutely nothing about the original fruit that in any way, shape resembles chocolate. It is a pod-shaped fruit. It comes in colors ranging from yellow to orange to lightish green to purple. And it's got these creamy, pulpy bits, right? Now, the pulp itself is quite sweet, and it already reveals some of this diversity. It comes in flavors ranging from like lemon, honeydew melon, peanut brittle. I mean, it's kind of shocking the diversity of flavor there because, again, I thought chocolate is one thing. A gentleman named Juan Carlos Motamayor is a plant geneticist, and he and a team of researchers have identified in a 2008 study 10 genetic clusters in cocoa, but now wow. They're up to and beyond 14 clusters, right? So there's not just one genetic type of cocoa plant. There's not just one type of flavor.
Is cacao endangered?
So it's interesting. We're wanting sameness, right? If you think of something like, I don't know, a Snickers bar or a Twix bar, that's what those large-scale manufacturers want. So the cocoa that we grow for all these, you know, large-scale commercial bars is typically a hybrid. And one of the most prolific hybrids is one known as CCN51. It grows really abundantly. It has high disease resistance, but we're wiping out all of this heirloom cocoa and deciding to grow this instead.
Back in my 20s, I kind of moonlighted for a little while as a chocolatier. This friend and I started making and selling chocolate truffles to local restaurants, which meant we were buying these huge 12-pound blocks of chocolate directly from importers. And we thought we were buying the best chocolate we could, and it was Belgian.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, this craft chocolate movement has just transformed what we think chocolate is. So talk about that, about the craft chocolate movement and what a difference it's made.
Absolutely. I've been so excited by it because it represents so many things. Every origin where cacao comes from offers up a rich diversity of flavors. So for example, Venezuela is known for cocoa that has really beautiful caramel notes. Ecuador is known for nutty flavors, for kind of like a brownish kind of rich cocoa. Papua New Guinea is very interesting in that people in country tend to dry the cocoa over diesel or over fire. So the cocoa takes on these sort of hammy notes. You go to a place like Vietnam and the cocoa there almost has some spicy notes. It's extraordinary the diversity that we can find if we allow it. And what the craft chocolate movement is trying to do is really reveal that flavor.
But this is where talking about food can sometimes sound kind of elitist. To say, I only eat $12 chocolate because it's so much better. So make the case for paying more for, say, single origin chocolate.
To eat that kind of chocolate is to support a different kind of system. And I'm not interested in those who do that for some sort of effete, show-offy kind of reason. What I'm interested in are farmers, and I'm interested in the people who actually make these foods. If we look at cocoa specifically, 70% of it is grown in West Africa. Over the last 2 years, roughly, give or take, the price of cocoa dropped about 36%. And these are farmers who are already at the margins. It was a study that was done in Ivory Coast saying farmers earn less than $2 a day. A brand new study that came out from the Fair Trade Foundation found out that most cocoa farmers in Ivory Coast live in what the World Bank classifies as extreme poverty.
Are you basically saying that pleasure is political? I guess I'm thinking radical.
For sure. Eating is a radical act. That's what I really want people to kind of understand, that pleasure that you're experiencing is coming at a pretty high expense. So maybe I should say savoring is not only a multi-sensorial act, smell, taste, touch, sound, and sight, but it's also one that is an act of transformation and is one that requires our whole being. You know, it's our heads and our hearts.
Does this change the way you taste chocolate, what you notice in eating chocolate, or what you think about?
What meeting farmers has shown me is that it takes a long time to create these foods, and so I slow down now. Even if it's just like a nanosecond in the morning with that cup of coffee, like, I'm not kumbayaing everything I eat, but it's taking a moment to really be grateful and to spend like one sip savoring that coffee, one bite really loving that chocolate. That encourages me to recognize those relationships. And when I recognize those relationships, they're ones that I want to support. And that might come through paying a bit more for a Kraft chocolate bar, writing a letter to a company, asking them what kinds of labor practices they have. It might be supporting particular legislation that will actually support farmers. There's a number of ways that this manifests, but I think it starts first by being conscious.
Well, I'm always struck by the link between taste and language. Part of developing an ability to really savor and pay attention to your food is also developing an actual vocabulary for it, which is hard at first. So you spent all this time with chocolate growers and chocolate makers. Tell us how to taste a bar of chocolate.
It starts with the chocolate that you choose in the store. Look for a bar of chocolate with a higher cocoa content. And I would look for one where they actually describe some of the places where cocoa is grown. Choose your chocolate bar and you take it home. What you want to do is recognize that this is a five-sense experience. So you want to actually smell that chocolate before you put it in your mouth. Open up your mouth a little bit as you're smelling it, because at the back of the throat, the retronasal passage connects, right? So you'll get an even bigger aroma if you have your mouth slightly open as you're inhaling that aroma of chocolate. Take a look at it. Notice the color, hold it up to your ear and break it in two. You'll hear a nice tight snap if the chocolate maker has tempered well. And then when you get it into your mouth, let it melt, because this is about a relationship. The cocoa bean is about 50% fat, right? And we call that cocoa butter or cocoa fat. But it's stable at room temperature, so all of those aromas, all those smells that are locked up in the fat start to release as soon as it starts to melt. So if you'll let that chocolate melt slowly, you're gonna get that full flavor expression. And then once you do, try it again. Typically, if you've got some of this like really interesting cocoa going on, it's not just one note. It's not just that straight up cocoa note, but it's got some variety. It's almost like a symphony. There's a beginning, a middle, an end. So the only way that we can keep this diverse, delicious stuff growing is by savoring it. We save it by savoring it.
Simran Sethi hosts the world's first in-depth podcast about chocolate. It's called The Slow Melt. She's also the author of Bread, Wine, and Chocolate. And if you had to guess, where do you think someone who adores food would live? Yep, Rome, where she can eat the world's best bread, wine, and chocolate every day. That's where we've reached her. So what does it mean to make your personal food choices, what you cook and eat every day, more authentic? For Michael Twitty, it's by tracing his family's food history back to the slave cabins and antebellum kitchens of the South, looking for his ancestors, dressing like his ancestors. Shannon Henry Kleiber is curious about all of it.
So I've seen you in pictures with some of these costumes on, and you have a bag around your neck sometimes. What's in that bag?
Sacred things.
Sacred.
Yes, things that are sacred to the wearer. If you go to West Africa, you see this kind of power objects around the necks of a lot of people, especially males. Certain confidences in medicines that you believe protect you or guide you, that represent your ancestors. That bag is hidden in plain sight. It is a part of the West African culture that endures for generations long after slavery, in fact. The religious culture and the spirituality went right along with the food and did not die.
Can you say what's in the bag?
Nope. I can tell you one thing that I do carry with me.
But if you want to know what it is, you'll have to keep listening. I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Okay, we left Michael Twitty about to pull something out of a bag.
I can tell you one thing that I do carry with me. I've had several of these, and once they get old and weathered, they kind of become their own kind of calcified artifact. The one I have is relatively new now, and it contains a fragment from a dish that was cast off from the big house at a rice plantation in South Carolina. And it was found in the grounds in the area where enslaved people had their quarters. So this was a dish that our ancestors ate from. And so for me, that fragment is around my neck as a constant reminder of who I'm doing this for and why the story needs to be told.
We're talking about authenticity in food and cooking, which is a hard thing to define. For Michael Twitty, it's about finding a way of cooking and being that honors his heritage. He's both Black and Jewish. He practices identity cooking, calls it kosher soul. And if you haven't heard of Michael Twitty, he's the founder of Afro Culinaria and author of The Cooking Gene, a book that won a James Beard Award. And he grew up in a part of the world that Shannon Henry Kleiber knows too.
You grew up in Maryland, right?
I grew up in D.C. and Maryland, yeah.
Me too. Do you think of yourself as being Southern?
Absolutely. The traditional folk culture and food culture of this area is definitely Southern, rooted in the South. The barometer that I use is that my father, who grew up in D.C. in the 30s, the minute that the train hit the Maryland border when he was visiting relatives in Philadelphia and New York, the conductor said, "All the colors to the back." Of course, in Maryland, you had separate facilities for everything. You couldn't go to the same school. You couldn't get married. The vote was suppressed, heavily suppressed. Neighborhoods were redlined. And it's unfortunate that we have to use that as the measurement. Mm-hmm. But it really does have a lot to do with how the culture in the area developed. And let's face it, all of our roads are tobacco roads.
In Maryland and in Virginia. That's right.
That's how they were created.
So the Southern part, the Maryland part, is part of your identity. You do identity cooking. I love that phrase. How have you found your identity in African-American, Jewish, gay culture through food?
I think it's impossible not to. I'm a little, as we used to call my grandmother, Grammy. So I'm a little Grammy. I'm a little Bubby. I'm a little queen mother of the house. I'm all of those pieces. And so for me, all those pieces come together whenever I walk into a kitchen because I realize I'm going in there with incredible armor. If all three groups are doing something, it must be genius.
But some of it is painful, too. I mean, in your book, you write about the whistling wok where slaves brought food into a room. They had to whistle to show they weren't eating it before. How did the history of slavery play into your research and thinking about how you present food to our modern culture?
I wanted to know where the food on our table came from. The Southern food, the soul food that my grandmother, you know, embraced, loved. And my other grandmother was exactly the same way, give or take a few things. Like my Virginia grandmother would make spoon bread. My Alabama grandmother would make sweet potato pie, pecan pie. Well, that wasn't a Virginia thing, but my other grandmother would make persimmon bread. And then my grandfather, who separated from my Virginia grandmother and divorced and got remarried, his household were all the usual suspects for South Carolina. Hoppin' John, which didn't really always have that name, but it was rice and peas and whatnot. Roasted sweet potato and collard greens and fried chicken.
That sounds so good. So
yeah,
tell me,
but you know, I didn't appreciate it when I was younger.
So you did not like okra. You thought okra was slimy and awful, and now you appreciate it and cook it.
Yeah, but I don't eat slimy okra. I mean, I know now I have a relationship with all of these different ingredients.
Right.
I think that's the most important part. I had to develop my own relationship with the ingredients, how I want to cook them, how I want to prepare them. At what point do I not like okra when it gets slimy? When do I like okra when it's a nice, crisp vegetable?
So tell me about rice. What does rice mean? What's the underlying thought when you're cooking rice?
I think the cultural stereotype is that rice belongs strictly to Asia. No, rice belongs to Africa and Asia, and independently was developed in Africa almost 4,000 years ago. Rice is a huge part of the African-American story, in that Africans brought from Madagascar, from Sierra Leone, from Liberia, from Senegal, from Gambia, from Guinea, introduced rice cultivation into the American South, which was a extremely lucrative crop, and that became part of the diet of every single person living in the Deep South in one form or the other. When we cook rice at home, we make proper rice. And when we say proper rice, Freda Mae Grosvenor of blessed memory, may she rest in power, would have said, we want every grain to be distinct and separate. We don't like our rice mushy. We don't do this thing where people, you know, they put the rice in the pot with 2 cups of water and 1 cup of rice. And next thing you know, they have this mush called rice. That's not rice. That's mush. But if you want rice, the way we make rice, you rinse the rice, you grit the starch off, you put it in the pot, you set it to boil. The craters start to form. You put the towel, the foil over top. And then you put the lid on top of that and you take it off the fire. And you wait 40 minutes after letting it cook for about 15. Sometimes we sweat the rice with the oil, you know, that too, before we put the water in or the broth in. I usually use broth. It should be the way they eat in West Africa, the way they eat in the Caribbean. It shouldn't be this massive wallpaper paste that people call rice. And unfortunately, the standards have been kind of limiting because they've come to define Black food identity. And my problem with that is that people are still creating new forms of soul food, new forms of food that's influenced by West Africa. And I think that we should always have open minds about that.
Is there a place for culinary appropriation, or who should represent what in the food world, and who's kind of in charge of this is my food?
Well, I certainly do believe that there is room for some level of food ownership, and there's also room for sharing. I think people confuse cultural appropriation with cultural diffusion. I've made the distinction that cultural diffusion is what happens in a multicultural society that's healthy. They have something, to bring to the table. Whereas in unhealthy multicultural societies or situations, one group that has the upper hand can take and extract elements of another culture, repackage it, resell it, and at a higher bidding price. And that often, unfortunately, is what happened with Black culture in America. It's happened with music, it's happened with fashion, it's happened with hairstyles, and it's happened with food. We need to have a sense of culinary justice. And culinary justice is all about making sure that those of us who come from communities that have been oppressed can make a living, can have a name, can exert our authority and cultural ownership over what we come from, what we have.
So what do you do to change that? Do you encourage people to delve into their own culinary histories? Your Southern Discomfort Tour is so cool about getting to know what you do. Should other people do that, and will that help?
Oh, absolutely. And also, for me, we've already had our first culinary tour of West Africa. We went to Ghana. We're going to Benin and Togo next year. And it's all about taking African-American chefs and culinarians to West Africa, especially those who've never been, and having them experience the food culture of their motherlands. It's also important for African-American cooks and chefs to go to urban and rural centers where Black food developed, not just in New Orleans and Charleston's, and not just the plantation either, to sort of like reclaim those roots. You can get a recipe anytime you want, okay? But can you get the cultural context and meaning behind that recipe? Can you really feel it? Can you really understand it? Can you appreciate it from the perspective of someone who was born into it?
Why do we want to know our food culture, our food history better? Is it to know ourselves better? Is it to live a more authentic life?
Absolutely. You may not know the name of every ancestor, but if you can reasonably assume or guess that you're eating something that they ate, there is something visceral about that. You know, there's a reason why for us Jews, Passover is celebrated by 99% in some form of the diaspora Jewish population. It's either a Seder or it's eating the matzah or it's doing something. Why? Because it's about not breaking a 3,000 plus year old chain. If you can feel the same experience eating that matzah, the recipe has not changed in 3 millennia. So just having that same experience is overwhelming.
How do you keep making it about life and love and learning and not about kind of the corporate way of feeding our families?
It's all about how you view the food process. But no, I have real restaurants that I love, and I tend not to get too attached to restaurants because, you know, the service can change at the drop of a hat. So as a consumer of color, to be quite honest with you, you can also come in situations where people react to you differently. I had that happen in New York one time, and it was heartbreaking.
What do you mean? How did they react to you differently?
We were profiled as non-tippers. And so the service we got was extremely subpar. I essentially called the manager over, and I called the server over, and I noted that she was very attentive to the other people who were there and very short and curt with us and wasn't very nice and really ignored us. And really, we weren't really a priority as people of color, as a mixed group, actually. I responded to the situation by saying, oh, I tip very well. And I told the manager to go grab his best dishwasher. And I looked at the young lady and I said, you know something? All we wanted was water. All we wanted was decent service. And we saw you give to everybody else. But, you know, since you didn't want to do that, that's okay. And I handed a $50 bill to the dishwasher. I said, this person deserves it because they put in the work. You didn't want a service. I guess our money's not good enough. You know, sometimes those microaggressions are very real. This is happening. What are you going to do about it? And then you speak up. And then, you know, you feel a lot better than if you just walked out and held that anger inside your gut. So to your question, I think that every time I get to do grandma cooking, you know, I get to cook with somebody's grandma. It's like the best. Because that's how that love and hope and that energy comes through. It's not about the recipe per se. It's about how they approach food. And then you remember their name and where you learned it. And then it's like, okay, everybody's narrative starts to bleed into everybody else's narrative. And it's very empowering. It makes you feel more human, more American, a part of something bigger than yourself in your own little bubble.
That's Michael Twitty talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber. Michael's the author of The Cooking Gene, which won the James Beard Award, and he's the founder of Afro Culinaria. So I don't know if you noticed, but there's a subtext running through this hour so far. Love. What would it mean to use love as a guiding principle in cooking and eating? Would that change how you shop for food? Would it change how you cook at home or the experience of eating out?
I had this pretty incredible meal when I was 19 years old at Chez Panisse restaurant in Berkeley. It was by far the most expensive restaurant I'd ever been to, so we saved $220 and we had this really magical meal there. It was a pretty classic French menu. Frisé salad au lardon, which has a poached egg and a mustardy vinaigrette and little pieces of crispy pancetta, halibut in broth, guinea hen with little wild mushrooms and green beans. The dessert was chocolate soufflé. I had never had chocolate soufflé before, or any soufflé. When the woman brought the chocolate soufflé, she said, would you like me to show you how to eat it? And I said, yes. She said, well, you take your spoon and you poke a hole in the middle. Then you pour this sauce in. It was like a raspberry sauce. So I did that and I took a bite. And she said, "How is it?" And I said, "Oh, it's really good, but you know what would make it even better? I would love a glass of cold milk." In fancy food, milk is only for babies. And I just had no idea how rude it was and like presumptuous to tell somebody in a restaurant how to make their food even better. So she brought me a glass of milk, and she also brought two glasses of dessert wine to teach us the refined accompaniment. It was really super sweet and just what I consider to be the beginning of my culinary education.
Samin Nosrat fell in love with a restaurant, Chez Panisse in Berkeley. Now, a lot of people have fallen in love with Chez Panisse. It's the legendary restaurant that launched the farm-to-table movement in America. And over time, Samin developed her own philosophy of cooking, based on a few universal principles: salt, fat, acid, and heat, which is the title of her cookbook, which won this year's James Beard Award. Now, Halima Shah has been thinking about our question this hour. What is real food, authentic food? And how does Samin compare what she learned at Chez Panisse to what she learned growing up as an Iranian-American kid in San Diego?
Oh, man, my mom is an extraordinary cook. And, you know, in our family, the highest compliment anything could get, any dish or food or ingredient, was that it tasted like Iran. I always joke that my brothers and I spent 40% of our childhood in the backseat of the Volvo station wagon driving around Southern California because my mom would drive. You know, on the weekends, we would go all the way to Irvine, like 100 miles away, to this bakery to get fresh Persian bread. She would drive across town to just get like just the right cilantro or the lamb that tasted the lambiest or the feta cheese that was the saltiest and tangiest. And so food, I think, was really the way that our family came together.
I have to say, I really relate to the driving long distances to pick up the best Persian ingredient. I'm from Chicago, and it's 2.5 hours from where I live now. I think every time I visit, I bring back a samosa haul because that's where the best Pakistani food I can find in the Midwest is. Or like I go to a halal meat store and bring back like $50 worth of meat, and the guy at the, register is like, "What are you going to do with all this chicken?" You do have a special connection to home cooking, and your book, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, feels like an anti-cookbook because it's not focused on recipes. Why did you choose to break down cooking into those four elements instead?
At the beginning of my cooking career, the chefs who were teaching me how to cook gave me a stack of cookbooks to go read. So that was what I understood cooking to be, was to go home, open a book, follow the instructions, measure the things, set the timer, and ideally make the thing that comes out of the oven or off the stove tasting right. And it never did. And that wasn't reflected at all in what I saw at work, which was constant tasting, constant tinkering, constant adjusting, that no 2 days we ever made things in the same way. Every single day we were just using taste and our senses to guide us. And I remember I had sort of a light bulb moment early in my cooking career when I understood that these four elements were guiding us in the kitchen, like points on a compass.
What do each of those do? What does salt, fat, acid, and heat do?
Salt. If there's one thing that everybody needs to learn how to use in the kitchen, it's salt. Salt enhances flavor. If you get the salt right, not just how much, but when and how, in what form to add it, you can just get your food really, really, really close to being perfect. Fat also affects flavor, especially choosing which fat we cook in will set a dish on a trajectory culturally. If you start with ghee, your food will taste like it comes from India or Pakistan because that's the fat they use there. And fat also determines texture, creaminess and crispiness and flakiness. So learning how to use fat and which fat to use creates exciting textures and flavors in our food. Acid, whereas salt enhances flavor, acid balances it. Acid provides contrast. And sometimes in just the tiniest form, so that you don't even taste the sour thing, it's just creating a little bit of a secret second layer in the taste. Lemon juice and vinegar the tang of cheese or yogurt. Chocolate is acidic, and coffee and tea, and even honey and even sugar. And of course, heat. Low heat over a long period of time or high heat over a shorter period of time. And that really is what determines the texture of foods. A lot of tender foods require high heat applied very quickly to preserve their tenderness. And a lot of dry, tough foods require water and low, gentle heat to become something tender and delicious and something that falls apart. And over time, over my cooking career, as I sat with these four elements and traveled and just learned more about cooking from different cultures, I saw that these elements are universal. Of course, different cuisines, you know, maybe have different tastes. Like Thai food has a lot of sweet and spicy and sour things. And Japanese food has a lot of umami and salt and sourness also and sweetness. But salt and fat and acid are basically just human things that as humans we've evolved to want in our food.
Well, you write that you were like a scholar in search of primary sources when you were trying to learn how to make various dishes authentically. Tell me about the people and places that taught you about food.
Well, probably the most formative place that I visited and the people who really taught me the most were, as a young cook, I moved to Italy and I lived there for 2 years. And there are a lot of things that I found really almost amusing as an outsider. One of them is the incredible regionality of Italian cooking. I, all the way across the world, had read books and studied and loved to eat, for example, fried squash blossoms stuffed with cheese. And one day I came and I tried to make those for my friends in Florence, in Tuscany, and they were all shocked. They were like, "You have invented the best thing. We've never heard of this. We've never seen such a thing." And I just was like, you know, this is from Rome, which is 150 miles away. Like, I didn't invent anything. But there's sort of this beauty that comes from the incredible investment that Italians have to their own traditional foods and to their place and to their people and their families and the way that their mom did it. And in some ways, their grandmas became my grandmas.
Well, that makes me think of this other question that's coming up right now in this time where our food is really intersecting with our politics, and that's the question of authenticity. Mm-hmm. For you, what does it mean to be able to cook something authentically?
Oh, man, that word I feel like is so loaded right now in this moment. And I think authenticity is sort of overrated in some ways.
Why?
Why is it overrated?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is something I haven't spent a ton of time articulating, but let me give you an example. So there's a great food writer and podcaster named Soleil Ho, and she wrote this piece that has just like sort of been reverberating in my head for probably the past year about assimilation food. You know, the food that immigrants cook in America with the ingredients that are available to them. And all of these weird, like, mashup dishes. And I think of the cooking that I do that I call Iranian and I feed to my friends in Berkeley. And I know that if my mother or grandmother saw that, they would be like, "This isn't Iranian food." So, you know, does that mean that it's not authentic? Does the stuff that my mom had to cook for us in San Diego using Californian ingredients, is that not authentic? To me, that was, you know, the most delicious and authentic stuff. And a lot of times when I went back to Iran and ate the stuff there, I was like, my mom's is better, you know? So I just don't know what authentic is and what the search for authenticity exactly, like what the value there is.
And I'm also really interested how your recipes are influenced by both your mom's home cooking and your training as a chef. One of the recipes you talk about in the book is for a Persian frittata. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. So that is something called kuku sabzi. So kuku is just sort of the Persian word for like frittata. And sabzi means greens. And my mom makes the best kuku sabzi. She chops mountains of herbs and greens and then uses the bare minimum of eggs to bind it together. So it's almost like you're eating this greens cake. And I had a lot of shame at first about sharing my mom's cooking in a professional kitchen because I thought it wouldn't be respected or valued in any way. And then at some point I started just making kuku sabzi and people started going wild for it because it was unlike anything that they'd ever seen. And it's so delicious and so nutritious. And my mom is really good at creating a really dark brown crust. So there's this sort of amazing contrast between the beautiful, almost burnt crust of herbs and then the inside tender eggs and much more fresh, vibrant greens. It's really an extraordinary thing.
That sounds totally delicious, and I'm cooking it next week. That was Samin Nosrat talking with Halima Shah. Samin's cookbook is called Salt, Fat, Acid, and Heat. And coming up, Steve heads to a local tap room to get a lesson in beer tasting. Well, first, beer sniffing.
There you go. This is 2014.
Intense aromas of charred oak, vanilla, caramel, and smoke. I put my hand over the glass a little bit to capture the aroma. Right. This must look ridiculous. I actually know which nostril is stronger for smelling beer. I am serious. Yeah.
Meaning so, what? Yeah, so what, you would like actually hold up your left nostril to the beer?
I lead with my left nostril when smelling beer. I've never shared that with anyone before.
It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. It wasn't that long ago that buying beer meant picking up a six-pack for the basement fridge or a keg for the frat party. Well, craft brewing changed all of that. Better ingredients, more alcohol, and a whole new world of stouts and lagers and lambics. And today, if you like beer, every glass can be a new adventure, as Steve Paulson is about to discover.
So we're sitting in the Funk Factory Gozeria tap room, and we've got a couple of beers in front of us. Tell us what we're looking at here.
We are looking at Bourbon County Brand Stout from Goose Island Beer Company in Chicago.
Two bottles.
Two bottles, yep. One from 2017, one from 2014.
I think there's something we got to do, right?
Open and drink them, yes.
There we go. This is 2014.
Steve's hanging out with beer writer Josh Noel, and the beer they're breaking out is a legend. Back in 1995, Goose Island Brewing had this crazy idea. What if we took an ostentatiously heavy beer, something originally brewed to impress Russian rulers like Catherine the Great, and then aged it in Kentucky bourbon barrels for a year?
Cheers.
Cheers, yeah.
Have you had many of these?
No. No, I'm a novice.
Have you ever had one?
I'm trying to think if I have. I don't know if I have.
I'll be very curious what you think. Yeah. Because this is a lot of flavor and a lot of booze for a first-timer. So the aroma is huge. Before you taste, I'm just curious, what do you smell there? There are no wrong answers, by the way.
It smells pungent, deep.
Smells some chocolate, some vanilla.
Some definitely chocolate. Mm.
Some oak.
Okay.
Some bourbon.
Yeah, bourbon. Yeah.
You get sort of that woodiness.
Yeah.
That's the time in the barrel. Hmm. Speaking of taste, shall we?
Do I get to drink?
Please do.
Oh, wow. That is so smooth.
It's really smooth, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess that's the sort of thing I wasn't expecting.
And this is 13.8% alcohol.
Yeah.
Beer is, at its best, just as complex as wine. Are you enjoying it?
I can already feel the effects.
Yes, you can. 14% hits you hard and hits you fast.
Okay, but here's the thing. In 2011, Goose Island Brewery, one of the leaders in the underdog world of handcrafted beer, sold to Anheuser-Busch, a giant manufacturer. And predictably, the beer changed.
Buckle up, because this one's probably a lot sweeter.
Okay, ready to go for the 2017 here.
Do you detect any difference in the aroma? It's a little...
It's not quite the 2014.
No, it's really not.
Huh, interesting.
It's a sort of one long, sweet flavor to me. It almost reminds me of chocolate syrup a little bit.
Yeah, you're right.
So yeah, there's more depth and complexity with the 2014. Yeah, yeah. And this is where we get into sort of what it means to be owned by Anheuser-Busch and to be a growing brewery.
Goose Island was the first craft brewer to go corporate, but it wasn't the last. And to understand why this matters and what's at stake, you have to go back to the beginning and understand what a revolution craft beer has been.
Absolutely. The way that we drink and talk about and think about beer. You know, we're sitting here in a tap room right now where the beer is made on site, right, essentially. That wasn't how we drank beer 30, 40 years ago. You know, we bought it in a gas station. We bought it in a supermarket. It was made in some distant place that we never got to walk into or see. And the whole experience has become so much more intimate and interactive, and it's
well. I mean,
beautiful.
you're also talking about how you have to have a language, you have to have knowledge on how to talk about this.
Well, you don't. I'm just talking about it like that because I talk about it all the time. But I mean,
there sort of is an element of being educated about how to appreciate it, just as with wine or chocolate or food.
Exactly, coffee.
Yeah.
And you know, I just thought of another thing. I get a little bit of marshmallow in this beer. Do you get
a
little?
Yeah. I mean, when you say that, yeah. See, that's what I'm talking about. It's like I wouldn't necessarily think about that, but when you mention that, then okay.
You're just going to have to drink a lot more of these, and then, and you'll get there.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned Goose Island, this iconic craft beer, was bought by Anheuser-Busch, which sounds terrible. Anheuser-Busch, the biggest beer company in the world, right?
I wrote a book about it. Long answer.
The iconic craft beer, Goose Island, is not supposed to be sold to Anheuser-Busch, right?
Certainly a lot of people would agree with that, yes. The Goose Island sale to Anheuser-Busch really sort of shot the craft beer industry off into a pretty wild new direction of mergers and acquisitions. Goose was the first, and there were a whole bunch after.
So there are two questions here. One is, why would Goose Island sell, presumably to make a lot of money? Why would Anheuser-Busch buy a craft beer?
Both good questions. So why a brewery sells varies. For Goose Island, it was in sort of a perfect storm where it needed a solution. Its founder was this guy, John Hall, who had made a very good living as a white-collar executive. He took a buyout with his company, Corrugated Box Company. Not the sexiest thing in the world. He was 45. He needed a second career, a second act. And the beer industry was just starting to take off. So John always liked beer, so he decided to start a brewery. Fast forward to 2011, Goose Island is a success. It's a thing. It's making some brilliant beer. John's approaching 70. And now he's ready to sort of slow down, hang out with the grandchildren, all that. So he needed an exit strategy. Goose Island was completely maxed out at its Chicago brewery. So it needed to be able to make more beer so that it could continue to grow. On the Anheuser-Busch side, Anheuser-Busch had spent the 90s trying to sort of half engage with craft beer and half thwart craft beer. Like those little craft brewery people, they gave us a little scare in the 90s, but we're all good now. By 2011, it was clear that craft beer had come back. It wasn't going away. The most effective way for them to jump in was to just buy someone who was already doing it and doing it well.
Sure.
And that matched up with John Hall needing an exit strategy, being offered $38.8 million. He didn't get all of that, but that was the price for the brewery.
It's a nice chunk of change.
It's a nice chunk. Yes, he's set. And he, you know what? He earned it.
He can take care of the grandchildren.
Yes, he can.
Did they know what they were getting when they bought Goose Island?
Great question, because the answer is no. And that was one of the most interesting things as I was reporting this book. They knew they needed it. They weren't quite sure why. They weren't quite sure how to use it. So they just sort of had it. A couple years later, they really shot it out of the Anheuser-Busch cannon. When Goose Island sold, it generated just huge cries of sellout and rage, and people were so angry, I'll never buy another Goose Island, you know. Jokes, you know, now it's going to be Budweiser Imperial Ale, you know, I mean, just the scorn rained down. Once Anheuser-Busch sort of figured out what it needed to do with Goose Island, with craft beer, it went on to buy 9 more breweries. Now they're very aggressive in the craft beer realm. Very, very aggressive.
So the big question, obviously, is what happens to a famous craft brewery once it gets bought out by Anheuser-Busch? Does the quality of the beer change? I'm assuming it's being brewed at a more industrial scale now.
You're right. It is. So I don't think there's one single answer for what it means when a brewery is bought out. Anheuser-Busch bought its 10. Miller Coors bought, I think they've bought 4 now. Heineken bought Lagunitas. Duvelmort got a Belgian company, bought 2 of the better breweries in the country, Firestone Walker, which may well be the best, and Boulevard Brewing. And what the sale has meant to each of those breweries, varies. Anheuser-Busch moved harder and faster with Goose Island than it did with any of its 9 other acquisitions. And Goose, I would say the quality has suffered somewhat as a result.
So why does that matter? Why does scale matter?
You know, that's a tricky answer. And that's probably something a brewer could answer better than I could. But it just sort of makes intuitive sense that just trying to do anything at a larger scale is generally going to be harder than doing it at a smaller scale.
Does local still matter with craft
beer? Oh, local's huge.
Why does that matter?
That's a tough question in some ways, but it's...
I mean, you're not just talking about scale here. You're talking about something else.
Well, the breweries that are doing the best right now are the really small local guys who are making very fresh beer and having a very intimate experience with their consumer. We're like this, where we're sitting right now. This is where Madisonians want to drink beer, you know? Yeah. I mean, you walk in here, it's a cool space.
Out of the way, almost kind of in an industrial part of the city here. You have to know about this place to come and find it.
Yeah, and this place has a national reputation. People love what these guys are doing. Yeah, this is a great place to come after work, right? I mean, it's just, it's like the ultimate neighborhood bar. It's
I mean,
a
so
cool
that's what
space,
you're talking about.
Cool
so the,
people,
so the ultimate neighborhood bar with great beer.
Great beer, yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying is you're talking about it's the experience of where you're drinking it rather than you just go and buy it and you drink it in your living room.
Yeah, that's what tap rooms have offered, and tap rooms like this are exploding. They're very much an engine of the industry right now. That said, far more beer is bought in a supermarket to be taken home and consumed on the couch. And that's what Anheuser-Busch is, you know, that's why they got involved.
Yeah, this has been fun. Here, cheers.
Cheers.
Josh Noel is a beer, food, and travel writer for the Chicago Tribune. His book about the history of Goose Island Brewing is called Barrel-Aged Stout and Selling Out. Plus, if you want to see a few photos from Josh and Steve's taste test, you'll find them on our website. That's at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. And like any good meal, this show comes together each week thanks to the combination of field-to-radio ingredients served up by our team of producers. A sprinkling of research from Shannon Henry Kleiber, a dash of edits from Halima Shah, a careful pour of field recording from Mark Rickers, seasoned thoroughly to taste with the humor of Charles Monroe Kane. Joe Hartke is our sound sous chef, and our executive chef is Steve Paulson. And speaking to you as the one who runs this entire operation, I'm Ann Strangechamps. And I want to thank you for sampling what we have on this week's menu. Until next time.